Hey, Zero Block 30 listeners, you can find us every Tuesday and Friday on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and YouTube. Prime members can also listen ad-free on Amazon Music.
Summer is all about the freedom to have fun. Forget a vacation and take a tequila-cation with new Truly Tequila Soda. This refreshing blend of real fruit juice from concentrate, sparkling water, and premium tequila blanco is the drink of the summer. Try all four refreshing flavors, all with 5% ABV and just 100 calories. Truly Tequila Soda. Keep it light. Hard Seltzer Beverage Company, Boston, Massachusetts. Please drink responsibly.
It's a Friday edition here on Zero Block 30, and today we have five rounds in the magazine. Round number one, heads up! It's a hypersonic Mach 5 missile accidentally falling off of an Air Force B-52 in California this week. I'm not sure what it did, but I'm sure, we'll start over. Kate wrote it like a fucking headline, all caps.
Oh, heads up, a Mach 5, oh, sorry.
It's okay. I was like, all right, here we go. It's a Friday edition here on Zero Block 30, and today we have five rounds of the magazine. Round number one, heads up. It's a hypersonic Mach 5 missile that accidentally fell off of an Air Force B-52 over California this week. I'm sure whatever it hit will totally buff out, and that's probably just because there was actually no nuclear bombs on that, luckily. That would have been actually bad. Nuclear bomb on accident, bad.
Not but that, good.
If you do that, that's a guaranteed fire watch. Mm-hmm. Round number two, if you ain't first, you're last, and even NASCAR has now pulled ahead of the old Army, Khan's beloved Army, in the race to get rid of all things Confederate. Who's slowing the Army car down? Cons, we're going to ask you about that. Round number three, Cons sat down with a decorated Vietnam veteran who you've probably seen before and didn't even know it. It's Colonel Sink, and I mean Captain Retired Dale Dye. And he's going to tell us how he parlayed a 20-year Marine career into three decades of Hollywood. I always love those stories because it's like guys like Arlie Ermey who go into like the Hollywood style before. I always wonder what their Marines thought. Like, what was Gunnery Sergeant Hartman actually like in the military? What was this guy actually like in the military? Then he goes to Hollywood. You have to know there's some Lance Corporal like, that dude?
Probably.
That guy's a fucking dick. How's he famous? He shouldn't be famous. That guy's a fucking dick. I'm not saying that's this fellow. That's just what I think. Round number four. The highest of highs, the lowest of lows. Not talking about old Katie mood swings on a period Tuesday. I'm talking about Kathy Sullivan, who is the first woman to walk in space, who also just reached the lowest point in the sea.
You know, and I wrote that round, and now that I'm looking at it, I'm like, this woman did this awesome thing, and I'm comparing it to my mood swings. And the so just everyone know a woman wrote this horrible one right there. That was me and not Chaps. That's terrible.
Thank you. I'm glad I didn't get canceled. It's Katie canceled, not Chapsy canceled. Yeah. I'm glad about that. And finally, round number five, we talked about it last Friday, but we got a hold of the soldier who was standing at the phalanx at one of the protests there in D.C. and telling him to tighten up. We talked to Wayne Carmaden about his experiences there protesting and possibility of going back into the National Guard now that he has that NCO taste in his mouth. Mm. We'll get into that in round number five, and all of that is going to be brought to you by our good friends at CBDMD, because if you know me at all, you know I need to relax, and you could probably tell by the sound of my voice I need it now. This has been a long week, man, unending. I had psychiatry, I had neurology, I had all kinds of appointments this week, and they just all back to back. It's like, I don't want to talk to you about my feelings anymore. Just let me fucking be. I just need to go in, get a little bath bomb from CBDMD with a little bit of menthol in it, throw that into the old tub and relax. And I did that thanks to our friends at CBDMD for their topical products. And you can get superior support and relief. Actually, their topical products. Whenever I was doing, I was telling Kyle about it. I was doing some carpentry goofing, like doing stuff around. The muscles that you use in carpentry, you don't use them in like anything else. So like when you're picking up long 2x4s or 2x6s or whatever, and you're swinging them, it's a little core workout. I rub some of that topical stuff on the old belly. I was feeling cool, calm, and collected. It was wonderful. Go to CBDMD.com. Use the promo code ZBD at checkout, and you're going to get 25% off your next purchase of superior CBD products from CBDMD.com. Make sure you go do that right now. Let's start the show, because Kate wanted to get the show started fast, because, folks, we're going to start off talking about chair and not the chair force. Let's get started with the show.
I just want to talk about, I got halfway through the teen, as Chaps has been calling it now, the quarantine, halfway through teen, I finally got a mini folding desk and a metal folding chair to sit on. And I have been sitting on metal folding chairs like my whole life. I don't know if it's that I hit my 30s. My ass has never been sweatier, dude. Every time I sit on this chair.
You've probably never done it for eight hours at a time.
That's the problem, is the duration is much longer.
I stand up out of this chair, and you would have think that I was just sitting in a lazy river.
I thought you were going to say ass bruises. From your tailbone.
I thought you were going to be sore.
I'm like having to change short. Like, I've never had this much ass sweat in my life. And I'm like, is it me or is it the chair? Am I going through like early menopause? I've never had worse swamp ass in my life. Anyway,
it sounds like the beginning of an ad. Hey, if you've had bad swamp ass while sitting in a metal chair, do I have the product for you?
New CBD swamp pads. No, yikes.
Promo code zero.
Well, okay.
What the fuck is going on?
Can I say something? I thought I was going to say this, and I thought you guys were going to be like, oh, yeah, when you sit in a folding chair.
No.
Man.
I mean, I would understand it if you were talking about a cloth chair or a leather chair. But that chair is breathable. You should have a little wind. You need some circulation in there, Kate.
I don't know if it's that, because it's painted neon orange, and I'm like, is it the paint? Is this like...
No, it's not the paint.
Like radioactive paint.
Do you have circulation going? Do you have a box fan, maybe?
Yeah, you need a fan of some
sort. I have literally one sitting... picking it up right now. It's right here. I have it going.
It's blowing?
Right now.
Oh, that's a Vornado. That's a good one,
right
too.
Next to my ass, and it's still... I have never
Wait,
in my
so
life...
So you have a Vornado blowing at point-blank range, and you're still a sweaty man bear pig?
I'm like, I've had to change underwear. I don't know. Is that not normal? That's not normal.
That wasn't English either. What is going on?
I thought I was going to get commiseration. Like, oh yeah, if you sit in a metal chair, you're going to be soaked.
No, this seems like very much a you problem.
Maybe I have a fever. Oh, man. Huh. Okay. Mm. Well, thought I was going to get a little commiseration.
Maybe you just need some more cowbell.
I am upset with myself.
Let's get into the actual show. Round number one. What do we got, Kate?
Well, first of all, I have a question for you guys.
Okay.
You ever sit on a metal folding chair and your ass just gets soaked? No. Okay, wait. Okay, but sometimes every now and then in the military, there is a major oops. And in this case,
it's an oop.
That's exactly what this B-52 said when the Mach 5 missile slipped off it by accident. But on a much smaller scale, I feel like the tiniest little mistake sometimes can lead to something huge like that happening. And I was looking at thinking about your guys' jobs, artillery and canine handler. And I feel like, do you ever have times where somebody forgot to lock a cage or somebody forgot to put, I'm picturing an enormous firing pin goes in an artillery thing. I don't know. Did anybody ever forget to, you know, like, was there ever an oops where you're like, oh my God.
Pulling back a huge hammer.
But where like a small mistake led to like a big thing.
So on a smaller artillery, you have the rounds, like on a 105 millimeter howitzer with the rounds, and there is gunpowder attached to a string. And depending on how far you're going to shoot, you shoot like a charge 2 or a charge 3, and that will dictate how many bags on the string that you place inside the round before you shoot it. Mm-hmm. So you say, an HE round charge 3. So you say 1, 2, 3, cool. Then you clip off the extra 3 or 4 bags that are bigger because you don't need those.
Yeah.
So I've seen guys where they miscount or they hear it wrong and they put the wrong amount of gunpowder in, and then that round goes much further or much shorter than where it's supposed to be.
Has one ever gone like off range, or the ranges are always big enough that they account
for for people being stupid and not knowing how to count past 5?
Oh man. Yeah. Not great though. Other than that though, there's never been like a, I'm just picturing one rolling down a hill or something because I know they're on wheels.
Did you ever kill anybody accidentally, Cons?
Hey, you ever have a horrible life-changing incident? I just saw
you. Hey,
Cons,
you ever walk in front of an artillery cannon right as it fires?
You guys ever commit like a war crime or anything?
Cons, You ever have a guy about to pull the string, but he's sitting on a metal folding chair and his ass is too sweaty and then he can't?
Hey, Cons, were any of your soldiers like completely incompetent?
I've actually seen, I saw one time, dude got too close to the freaking cannon. So when the string got pulled, he took a shot to the gut. That didn't tickle.
Oh, God. Do you, when you pull the cord, how hard? Is it like, I'm picturing my push mower growing up that I had to turn on and my dad would be like, come on.
You don't have to pull the string
like the
that
last
hard.
Day of period Tuesday, you got a heavy flow in.
Yank that string out of him.
You don't have to pull the string that hard, but the blowback on the cannon is very forceful.
I wonder, there's women in the artillery now, as mm-hmm. there should have been for a hot minute. I do wonder if they chuckle on tampon days.
I'm sure there's some tampon jokes that have worked their way into the red leg world.
Indeed.
Oh, red leg? Come on.
That's what artillery people are called, red legs.
No disrespect to Christina Aguilera.
No, definitely not. You're right. A niche joke there, but I get it. Anyways, chaps, have you ever anything like that?
Yeah, man. I mean, that's part of canine is that the first day whenever you're an instructor, you're teaching all the different handlers of how to go in because people are scared. It's not like no other job in the military do you just go in and you just kind of have to be with this creature that could eat your fucking ass that day. So you have people who have never been around large dogs, never been around like policing dogs or working dogs, and they have to go inside the kennel. And whenever they're doing that, the instructor's not in there with them. I'm not there like to go in and save them if something happens. They just got to go in themselves. So when somebody leaves the door open, it's dangerous because they have all these different handlers that never been around dogs and then one's loose. And the Malinois, when they see somebody get nervous or they start moving a certain way, they're like, oh, shit, it's time to fucking go. Let's go. My favorite unsecured story, though, I was getting a chirp on my next cell when I was I think I was a chief trainer or something like that at Quantico. And we had done nighttime training. My Marines had taken back the dogs in this long kennel that we would transport like 15, 20 dogs at a time. And they were back at the base. I was like, hey, you guys go ahead and go back, take care of everything. I'm going to head home because I was right by my house anyway. Put the dogs up and then I'll see you guys at noon tomorrow. And they were like, cool. So I get a chirp at like 3 o'clock in the morning and he's Docker, who's actually been a guest on the show. He was like, hey, Sergeant, Santo is out and he is circling me and Sergeant Gehring like a shark. I was like, what? And Santo was this like 120-pound Czech Shepherd, the biggest military working dog I've ever seen. And I was scared of him. I was his handler for like 6 months. And I was like legit scared of Santo that he was going to eat me. Mm-hmm. So these guys, I know they were terrified of him because he was just mean. Like he shouldn't have been a working dog. He was just mean.
Yeah.
And so I was like, well, did you try to give him a treat or something? Like, and I'm trying not to laugh. They said it took him an hour and a half to like comp. Santo just had to get tired of running around and barking at them on top of the trailer.
Oh God. So they're on top of it. And he was just,
yeah, they're on top of this large trailer. Like he's circling us like a shark.
Oh my God. What a sight. I would never ever want. And also too, I think about it, especially with that, like you forget to lock a cage on Camp Pendleton where the canine, sorry, there's like a million sirens going by my apartment right now.
It's fine.
But they,
such is the teen.
Such is the teen. The kennels were not far from officer housing. And it's like, oh my God, if a dog like Santo took off and like went into a neighborhood or something, like you have to be so fucking careful.
Well, that happened on Pendleton. And when that kind of thing happens in the dog world, everybody in the dog world knows about it. They're like, oh, yeah, dude. They lost a dog on Pendleton for like 4 days one time.
Oh, my God.
Can you imagine having to look around? There was a dude, my favorite lost dog story. There was a patrol going, like a convoy going between Ramadi and Fallujah. And one of the dogs got out to go like take a shit or take a piss. And so the handler, he was an SSD dog. The handler took him off leash because SSD dogs are trained to come back. I mean, they are off leash all the time. Mm-hmm. So they can go out 1500, 2000 meters away from you and you can call them back on command or with like a radio or something. Well, this dog just, I guess he just was like, fuck it. I'm tired of riding in this hot ass Humvee. This is not what I want to do with my life. And he was just like, pew, gone into the desert. And he didn't come back. The guy was hit. The handler was hitting like the shock collar.
Imagine
he was so
having
far
to
away.
Walk back to the vehicle and be like, guys, there's a problem.
No, it's, I mean, because you only get out like 15 meters away when your dog's going to the bathroom. You just let him out. You usually hold him on leash, but because a lot of the SSD dogs are so used to being off leash, they don't want to go on leash. So he just took off. And they stayed for like 45 minutes. They took a patrol to go down and look for this dog. Eventually, the convoy commander called back and he was like, I don't give a fuck about the dog. We'll put it down as a loss. We got to go. We're in like a dangerous spot right now.
What's that? Yeah. What's that cost? What's that marked down as?
Like 75 grand. I mean, it's a lot. Like maybe more for SSD, probably closer to 100. Holy, I mean, because the amount of time that it takes, like the initial training and then the training with the handler and things like that.
Yeah.
But even like the money be damned, because when we talk about like the military budget, you drop a fucking 500-pound bomb, that's tens of thousands of dollars. So that amount of money in a war zone really is nothing.
Did they get it back?
It came back like 2 weeks later.
Holy shit.
This makes me, I just had a brand new idea. Homeward Bound 2, Lost in Fallujah. A couple wily dogs get out. They meet an Afghan cat named Sassy. And they're like, we're gonna always wonder, do it.
I know it's not the case because all of the working dogs are neutered for the most part. I mean, occasionally you'll find one that's not. But you go back because, you know, the old jokes about, like, you go to Vietnam and there's some kids that have, like, blue eyes and blonde hair.
Oh, dude,
like,
I used to see all sorts of kids on the streets of Iraq. You're like, you don't look like you're from here.
Yeah, same thing with these dogs. Like, you are not a normal Iraqi mangy little fucking mutt. You look like a Malinois.
Right. Maybe Lady and the Tramp. It's just like an hour of a Malinois humping one of those pounds. Anyway, lots to think about.
Spaghetti, they're just having some nice hummus and some falafel.
Yeah, perhaps. So there's movies to be made.
Sounds delightful.
Hopefully there's not an errant artillery round downrange when there's a lost dog out there in the desert.
Yes, little very double, true. A double nice whammy, combo. They call that. I have one more question. You ever have a working dog who's been sitting on a metal chair too long and his fur is just soaked and he cannot? Okay, round number one. Here we go. Finally getting into it. This is from David Axe at Forbes. An experimental Mach 5 missile accidentally fell off a B-52 test plane during trial over California this week. The hypersonic air-breathing concept missile, or a Hawk, was destroyed when it struck the ground at Edwards Air Force Base. DARPA wanted to come at us about thinking Bob Dole was dead. DARPA,
make sure your own house is fucking
make
in
sure,
order.
Yeah, don't throw stones at a glass.
There you go.
Folding chair.
For reference, anyway, real quick, Mach 5 is 3,836 miles per hour.
Pretty quick. And so this is one of the several super fast missiles that the Air Force is developing in order to help its ancient B-52
bombers. Oh, is this one of the super duper ones that they were talking about?
Yes, super duper. super duper is the mother of all. But anyway, these ancient B-52s, they're like, we're not going to update them. We're just going to strap cool new bombs to them. So this is part of that to help poke holes in China and Russia defenses. It's a scramjet, meaning the missile has an engine and breathes air like an airplane does. So it's kind of like its own plane. It's like its own plane of death, I guess you could say. Other hypersonic weapons, such as the air-launched rapid response weapon, boost to hypersonic speed atop a rocket that then glides them at 5 times the speed of sound. Not the thing you want accidentally falling off your airplane and going rogue. Like, it does the dog thing. It detaches and it's like, fuck it, I'm out of here. It just like takes off across the Pacific. So anyway, this is kind of a big deal that the test is not going right because Congress gave the military $2.6 billion with a B for hypersonics research this year.
See, when you say that, losing a 50 grand dog's like nothing.
Nothing.
Yeah. It's like, oh, we can afford that.
Yeah.
As part of that overall funding, the Air Force got $20 million to develop the Hawk in 2020, as well as $286 million to work on a couple other bad boys. The Air Force wants hypersonic missiles badly in order to complicate Russia and China's own planning. And somebody said, we could carry more of them on a bomber, but we could also carry them on our fighters. And that opens up the entire Air Force quiver. And I don't know what an Air Force quiver is, but that was Will Roper, a top weapons buyer for the Air Force. What a job to be the top weapons buyer for the Air Force. That guy fucks. Sorry, that's probably too much to say.
Oh, I think that's fine.
He's throwing some Will Ropers out there. No, that's too much.
You ever see the top Air Force guy for weapons come in and your ass is all sweaty from your metal chair?
Yeah.
And you're like, no, it's totally not normally like this.
He's trying to sell you a weapon, but you're just...
I heard that thing goes Mach 5 and eats air. You eat ass?
Yeah. So anyway, that is... Sure, Will Roper will enjoy that. But... again, so these highfalutin big deal kind of things. Oh, our guy Kyle just sent us a picture. Will Roper. Oh, he's got one of those John Travolta butt chins, so he probably does.
Oh, yeah.
Probably does Gaston. Have a great time. Yes.
So anyway, this thing's flying over. It falls out of the sky. Not great. I would love to be the ones, because you know so many people are watching this. It's kind of like that scene where Kim Jong-un is watching his artillery and what they're doing, and you're sitting there. Because you know when they spent $2.7 billion or whatever developing this weapon, there's some high-ranking folks that are watching this demonstration go down, and then they have to get on the radio, and it's like PFC Pooh's like, "Oh, Christopher Robin, we accidentally let the very expensive missile that breathes air like a human go Mach 5 on accident."
And here's the thing, too, I want to know, like, who was the one? Because, you know, it's going to fall on somebody. Everybody else has got to watch their ass till it falls on somebody. Probably the lowest rank's going to get shit on for it. But
dear.
Yeah. So I want to know, like, was it just not strapped in well enough? Did somebody accidentally hit a button? Like, how does a Mach 5 missile?
Yeah, you'd think there'd be like multiple layers of you can't fuck this up.
Yeah.
It's tied on with 550 cord. Like, somebody cut it down. Yeah, it's like, what the fuck?
Well, that kind of thing happened to me. You always think these checks are in place. I was doing this, has nothing to do with the military whatsoever, but I was looking for new insurance today and going through, and I was on a website, I won't say the company's name, trying to switch over to them. And because I think I'm paying way too much in insurance. And so I was going to a different place and it said $187 for your every month for your three cars. And I was like, that's not bad. That's a lot better than what I'm paying now. Well, then they say, oh, we found this claim on a stolen vehicle for this much. We need to add that in. And then I said, okay. And then they said, we processed your payment. You're welcome. And then it went up by like 50%, 75%. Way more. You would think there'd be another screen that I have to say, yes, I agree to this coverage and this price and this plan and all these things. It wasn't. It was just automatic. And I called the place, told them what happened. They said, oh, this is like the third time this happened today. It's like, you should probably fix that.
Maybe you should look into that.
And maybe the person who was the bomb releaser was trying to buy insurance online while they were in the air and they accidentally hit the wrong button. And that
or what if it's on like an app, like you have it on your phone and you're trying to, it's frozen. So you're trying to close it out. But instead of closing out, you actually click okay.
What if the bomb just got real sweaty? It was real slippery.
Oh, God. Let's move on to round number two. What do we got for round number two? Cons, we'll start right here because this is kind of your neck of the woods a little bit, Army. You've spent some time.
I was in the Army once upon a time. Spent some years there. And obviously the hot button issue right now has been the Confederate flag and the Confederate statues and the naming of various bases across the military that bear Confederate names and removing them, rightfully so, because of what they represent. And there's some news this week coming from NASCAR. They released a statement. They said, "The presence of the Confederate flag at NASCAR events runs contrary to our commitment to providing a welcoming and inclusive environment for all fans, our competitors, and our industry. Bringing people together around a love for racing and the community that it creates is what makes our fans and sport special. The display of the Confederate flag will be prohibited from all NASCAR events and properties." So,
can I say really quick, the collective sound that erupted when that tweet went out?
I loved it. What was your first, whenever that tweet went out, was your first instinct? What did you do?
We work NASCAR.
Yeah, we love
time.
NASCAR.
We've been to several races, and you could tell they're trying to grow. And they've said part of the stagnation.
Not responsible, Kate. What did you actually do?
Fuck yeah, I retweeted it. But they've been trying to.
Went straight to those comments. Like, what? I went straight there, dude. I went there, and I went to the NASCAR Reddit, and like, oh, what the fuck is this?
These
liberal pussies.
The best comment was this comedian that I follow. She was like, "I'm just here in the comments for the same reason I go to NASCAR events, to watch the wrecks." It was just like, people,
that one guy that's like, "I'm going to quit and sell all my shit." And somebody was like, "Dude, you haven't finished better than 32nd in the truck series
all
year.
You're like the worst NASCAR driver ever." So definitely a collective. But one of the comments I started seeing popping up and that I thought myself was, if you ain't first, you're last. And the Navy, the Marine Corps, the Coast Guard, like all the other branches have said, all right, Confederate stuff, we're done with it. Get it out of here. NASCAR has said we're done with it. Cons, what's the Army been up to, my friend?
Yeah. Well, they're kind of, for whatever reason, they're dragging their feet. And Army Secretary Ryan McCarthy, he said he's open to the idea of renaming Army bases following the Marine Corps' decision to ban Confederate symbols from all of its installations. Then on Tuesday, the Navy announced a partial ban on Confederate paraphernalia.
I think what the heck's a partial? Okay. I've read that they've since gone full, yeah. So
what was a partial, though?
Confederate bikinis. The bikinis were still
around. Oh, yeah.
Got it. Right. Got
Days
it.
Of Duke, right.
So the at this point,
bikinis, yeah.
At this point, you're like the kid in class who doesn't have the new sneakers that everybody else has. It's like, Army, get with the program here. But so on Wednesday, the president tweeted that 10 bases are not only a part of American history, they represent the U.S. military at its best. Kind of interesting. His rationale was, the United States of America trained and employed our heroes on these hallowed grounds and won two world wars. Therefore, my administration will not even consider the renaming of these magnificent and fabled military installations.
Now,
that's a stretch. Because I can tell you right now, I didn't go to Iraq and think, man, I better not let General Hood down.
Right. God,
I hope Camp Foster's doing okay.
Goodness gracious. What would General Bragg think of me?
And
unbelievable.
Too, this one paragraph here, like among the bases that they're named after, Gordon is believed to have become a leader of the Ku Klux Klan in Georgia. Pickett ordered the execution of 22 prisoners who had switched from the Confederate to Union. Bragg was fired after being defeated at Chattanooga and was roundly despised by his peers. Even the Southerners were like, that guy's a loser. And Hood's military career came to an ignominious end after his army was smashed at the Battle of Nashville. So it's like, here's 10 loser bases. Like, with why? Why can't
and
you
not
just
only
get rid
that,
of
you could have such a win. Like, from it, politically, to me, it seems stupid. Yeah. Like, if you go out there and you're like, you know what, we're gonna have these new faces that represent what we are now, what we're striving to be. This is going to be. It's going to be no longer. It's going to be Fort Bragg. It's going to be Fort Groberg after Floyd Groberg, and talk about what he does. And he's going to be alive and be able to be like an ambassador for that base and things like that, or former Medal of Honor recipients.
Well, I was going to say this is a great chance for, because we've been talking about in previous episodes, and I've been doing a lot of research on how people of color throughout military history have been slighted, have been not given the awards that were due, have been kind of brushed out of the history books. This would be a great chance to turn that around and have 10 people of color, maybe even a woman. God forbid.
No.
I mean, God forbid. Just... but maybe even switch
let's
it up a little
overreact.
Bit. Yeah, so, yeah.
Let's not go too far.
Okay. All right. Well, there's a bunch of redbikes walking around over there.
You know what they should do, though? We've actually had this issue because now, with the way things are and the way things will be in the future, things are going to come up. No one's going to have a life that is perfect that you should name all these different things. You can go and you can nitpick everybody's life if you're naming it after a building, or if you're naming a building after a person or something like that, where eventually somebody's going to say, well, they also did this or they did that. I think these are pretty extreme examples, but even if you would name it after somebody, why not just do it after traits? Like if you want to have like Fort Integrity or Fort Courage or something
oh,
like
God.
That, something that's never bad.
Fort Glow Belt. Fort Agro.
Yeah, I don't know. I do like
0 to 3.
Fort Zero Blood 30. No, but I mean, there's just so many great options of people that have served in the Army that you could pick a ton of them and slap their name on a base, and it would make a whole lot of sense. And what General Petraeus, David Petraeus, said, I thought was great. He said, "We do not live in a country to which Braxton Bragg, Henry L. Benning, or Robert E. Lee can serve as inspiration. Acknowledging this fact is imperative. Should it fail to do so, the Army, which prides itself on leading the way in perilous times, will be left to fight a rearguard action against a more inclusive American future, one that fulfills the nation's founding promise." So he's like, hey, get with the times and move forward, or we're going to be left behind. And he's absolutely right.
And with this kind of stuff, don't make your last ditch stand in the wrong fucking ditch. I think this is just, you can obviously tell the winds of change are swirling, and you have to react to those.
I think
it's pretty simple. Sorry, Kate, though. Just real quickly, hold that thought. Anything named after a Confederate, they lost.
Right.
They lost. They're losers. No matter how you shake it down south that you are proud of them or that's your heritage, I don't care. They lost. America.
I've never understood it. Like, I am from the South. Like, I'm from Jacksonville, Florida. It's named after fucking Andrew Jackson. Like, I am from that area. I have never understood. To me, it's always been the flag of a traitor. Like, that you went against the United States.
Yeah.
This is what I'm seeing so much of. All these people that think that war was about slavery. It wasn't. This is our head. Actually, like, I feel like that has been a thing that's kind of been taught to us. Well, it wasn't really. That slavery was like a little part
about
of it.
States'
but it wasn't.
Rights. Yes. But wait, states' but rights wait, to own slaves.
It was about slavery. It truly yeah. was. The original documents of the Confederacy show clearly that the war was based on slavery. For example, and this article I went state by state, seeing their declarations. In Mississippi's Declaration of Secession, this was their main point. Our position is thoroughly identified with the institution of slavery, the greatest material interest of the world. A blow at slavery is a blow at commerce and civilization. And pretty much all the other Southern states had similar as their main things, talking about going into the Civil War. So don't tell me it wasn't about slavery. And two, again, I feel like Trump saying, like, you know, so many heroes. There's probably a lot of heroes that have left those bases and those forts and those camps that their family members were slaves. And I bet they don't love it. So let's include them in it, too. Like, NASCAR is ahead of the Army because they said inclusivity is more important and wanting people to feel like they belong. Don't you want all your soldiers to feel like they belong? Like, what the fuck? Get out of here. I'm pissed. My ass is, let me tell you right now. These Hanes, I could wring them out.
Yeah, I mean, it's a simple thing, and hopefully now with all the other branches getting on board, I hope that the Army will not be very far behind at this point.
Yeah. Get it together.
Yep. Let's move on to round number three.
All right, so round number three, we have the interview that I did with Captain Dale Dye, and this was especially enjoyable for me. You know, it was one night I was sitting there watching an episode of Entourage and he popped up and I realized, like, this guy has been in so many.
Handsome as fuck too.
Oh God, he is handsome. He really is a fine looking gentleman. He's been in so many iconic military movies, but I wanted to know, how do you go from being in the military for 20 years to now being the foremost person that is consulted when somebody wants to make a military movie? So here's my chat with Captain Dale Dye. All right, joining us now on ZBT is especially enjoyable guest for me, being the resident movie and television buff. But this gentleman had a 20-year career in the Marines and then followed that up with his current profession, working for the last 35 years in various projects. Some you might recognize: Platoon, Born on the 4th of July, Saving Private Ryan, Mission Impossible, Band of Brothers, just to name a few. But joining us today is Captain Dale Dye. Welcome, sir.
Thank you. Thanks very much. Great to be with you.
It's great to have you. And just to start, how did you find your way into the Marines? Because as I mentioned, you had a 20-year, very fulfilling, very decorated career in the Marines before you even got into Hollywood. So what was the impetus for joining the Marines?
Well, I had graduated from Missouri Military Academy, and I had great visions of having a stellar career as an officer. Mm-hmm. And I tried to get into the United States Naval Academy. In fact, I tried three times. Mm-hmm. And failed all three times. I had, you know, played too many sports and chased too many girls in high school and hadn't paid enough attention to the STEM curricula, if you will.
Sure.
And so I was pretty down about it. You know, there wasn't any money in those days. There weren't great opportunities for scholarships and that sort of thing. And certainly a bozo like me wasn't going to get an academic scholarship. So I was pretty down about it. And I was walking along a street in Cape Girardeau, Missouri, kind of southeast Missouri where I'm from. And it was sleeting. And I was miserable, and I didn't have any idea what the hell was going to happen with my life whatsoever. And I see this big sign outside of a post office, and it's got this Marine, this lantern-jawed, rock-jawed Marine in dress blues, and he's pointing a finger, and he's saying, "Ready?" And I looked at that, and I said, "You know, by God, I think I am." So I went in and enlisted, and that led to what I think was a really adventuresome and wonderful career. I'm proud of every day I served and very happy with what happened.
Mm-hmm. So really
even
serendipity.
The bad times were good.
Right. So really some serendipity there with that sign. But and then you joined it 1964 and then 1965, we find ourselves embroiled in Vietnam and you found yourself in some of the most iconic battles in early on in those days in Vietnam.
If battles can be iconic, yeah, I was
maybe
there
more right well known is a better way to put it. Well known battles.
So. Yeah, right time, right place, or wrong time, wrong place, depending on how you look at it. But you know, I spent about 33 months all told on the line, and in particular, I think what affected me most, what taught me most about human nature and human beings in combat was Tet Offensive 1968. I fought in Hue. Mm-hmm. And boy, that was a meat grinder. It really was. We had no idea. We'd been taught to fight in the jungles and sort of a anti-guerrilla warfare configuration, and then comes Hue. Mm-hmm. We were in the middle of a huge city. And things were so close. You fight in jungles and in forested areas, and you tend to shoot at shadows and at muzzle flashes. In Hue, it wasn't like that. In Hue, you were looking right in his beady-ass eyeballs, and he was looking in yours, and the better man survives. What it did for me, not only did it imprint on my psyche forever, but it showed me, I think, that in combat, in close combat, what you see is the absolute best of mankind and the absolute worst of mankind.
Certainly.
And I think anybody who's seen that and survived it, it'll mark them forever. Now, having said that, I don't mean that it creates huge psychological scars. If we're healthy, we can learn to survive that. We can learn to deal with that. But we'll never forget it. And I think it's a good thing that we'll never forget it. That's a windy answer to what you asked, but there it is. No,
it's a great answer, but you're absolutely right. It will shape you for the remainder, not just your career in the military, but then the remainder of your life. So I can certainly see how that would resonate with a lot of people. And you had a somewhat of an unconventional career in the Marines only because you were a Mustang. And you decided, what was the decision to go from the enlisted to the officer side?
Well, it was a bit out of my hands, the truth be told. I had reached the rank of Master Sergeant. And at that time, the war was over, or our involvement in the war was over. This is around 1975. Mm-hmm. And the Marine Corps had a new commandant, a Medal of Honor man by the name of Wilson, who decided that he was going to clean up the Marine Corps. He was going to take all of the stuff that had the bad vibes that had come with Vietnam, and he was going to clean it up, and we were going to get back to basics, and we were going to get back to leadership and that sort of thing. And to do that, it's kind of a Marine Corps thing. We're very big on Mustangs. Mm-hmm. And to do that, he decided that he was going to take some proven enlisted leaders, senior enlisted leaders, and make them officers. And use their experience and their leadership potential in a broader reach. And so I was called into the commanding general's office and told in no uncertain terms that I was headed for Quantico.
Mm.
And I said, no, see, wait, because I'm going to make sergeant major eventually. And,
right.
And I don't have a college degree. And the general just said, shut up. And when you hear that from the CG, you shut up and you go to Quantico, which is what I did.
Mm-hmm.
But because I didn't have a college degree, I was commissioned after OCS and the basic school as a warrant officer.
Mm-hmm.
So I became a warrant officer and served as a warrant officer for about 3 years. And then I had an opportunity to convert my commission. I was a CWO, commissioned warrant officer. Mm-hmm. And I had a chance to convert my commission. So I applied, and during that 3 years that I had been as a warrant, I'd gone to school and I'd managed to get a degree from the University of Maryland.
Okay.
You know how that happens. You go to school at night and so on. Well, I did that and got a degree in, of all things, English literature. I think the Marine Corps was shocked to its very soul that I got a degree in English literature. But they managed to convert my commission. So I went from chief warrant officer to first lieutenant. Mm-hmm. And then made captain. And at about that point in my career, we were involved in the Middle East. We had sent some folks to Beirut, Lebanon. Mm-hmm. So I went to Beirut in 1982 and 83, and that was kind of my last quasi-combat assignment.
Right, right. I mean, so you're the first gentleman I've ever met who has served both enlisted, warrant, and as an officer. So I think that in and of itself is interesting.
Well, it gives me a broad base of reference.
Right.
And I've used that in my follow-on career.
Right. So let's talk about your follow-on career. You served for 20 years in the military. And then did you just wake up one morning and say, you know what, I really want to make a go of it in Hollywood? Or did you find your way there in another way?
I'll tell you, when I retired from the Marine Corps, I was really a little lost lamb. I had no idea what I was going to do. I knew a few things. I knew that if I didn't do something, I'd end up at the VFW on a bar stool and become the resident barfly.
Right.
And that wasn't good for me. And I knew that if I took a job in the defense industry somewhere and became a cubicle rat, I'd be a suicide in 6 months. So, I'm just not that guy. So I got to thinking about it and I said, look, what can I bring to the table? And I drank a bunch of beer and did a bunch of fuzzy headed navel gazing and tried to figure out, what were my assets. Mm-hmm. And a common denominator seemed that I'd been a movie fan. I'd seen every war movie there was. Mm-hmm. And what was common there was that almost all of them pissed me off.
Because
they weren't us. Mm-hmm. They missed who we are. They missed our heart, our psychology, our dark humor, how we survive things. That was missing. We were all portrayed either as poor schlubs, drafted by an ungrateful country, or we were flag wavers, or we were unthinking lifers, and all of that was nonsense. And I just got to thinking, when you're ignorant, you can do a lot of things that people tell you you can't do, and I think that was my case. I said, why are they doing this? There's got to be some reason they're doing this. That's stupid. That's wrong. Mm-hmm. And I know that the truth is much more dramatic. So I think I'll just go out to Hollywood and unscrew it. What I mean by, when you're ignorant, I had people tell me, look, what are you doing? You're nuts. They've been making zillions of dollars for decades, making war movies without some clown like you coming in and telling them they're all wrong. Mm-hmm. And that there's a better way to do it, and the truth is more dramatic. I was having a tough time, even though I was finding my way in to talk to people in showbiz. What I was finding was that there was a certain bias against military people in Hollywood, and it was simply this: people who had never served had no idea that people who had served might have some creative input.
Sure.
They thought we were all nose pickers and knuckle draggers or we would be doing what they're doing and making movies and that sort of thing.
Right.
And that attitude was really there. Mm-hmm. And they were looking at me and they were saying, hey, look, how couldn't you can't be creative. You spent most of your life in the military wearing a uniform, doing what you're told. How can you be creative? And I was really on my last legs. I'd tried for about a year, mm-hmm. out here in Hollywood, and really had run up against some absolute stone walls. And I'd tried everything. I'd tried the Marine method. I would go on a studio lot and spot some guy wearing a tie and carrying a briefcase and I'd snatch him up by the stacking swivel and say, hey, you make war movies? Well, you're screwed up, and here's why. Of course, I'd get escorted off the lot. And so I was about to give it up. I was about to say, okay, I'll go be the bar fly or the cubicle rat or I'll go be a cop, although I'd been shot too many times to really want to get involved in that sort of mm-hmm. thing. So I had learned to read the trade papers, Daily Variety and the Hollywood Reporter and that sort of thing. And I was paging through them one day. And I noticed a little article, I think it was an Army Archer's column in Daily Variety, that said a heretofore relatively unknown writer-director by the name of Oliver Stone was going to do a movie based on his own personal experience in Vietnam as an infantryman.
Right.
And I said, oh, Christ, here it is. I mean, if I can get to this guy, he'll get it, what I'm trying to tell him about what's wrong and what's right with war movies. And I would tell you how I managed to get his home phone number, but I'm not sure the statute of limitations has run out.
We'll let that one slide then.
Yeah, let that one slide. But I did. I got his home phone number, and I called him. And I said, look, you don't know me, and I don't know you, but if what I read is true, you need me to help you tell this story. Mm-hmm. And I guess anybody but Oliver Stone probably would have had me arrested.
Right, but having served himself, I'm sure that boded well for you.
Well, I made this quick pitch, and it resulted in a meeting that we had, and we kind of sniffed each other like strange dogs, examine each other's bona fides, and I said, look, and I know that no actor, no matter how great he is ever going to be able to understand what was in our mind and in our hearts and in our guts in Vietnam unless I expose them to that. And so he said, maybe you're right. And he gave me 3 weeks in the Philippines mm-hmm. with 33 actors, many of whom were unknown at the time, Tom Berenger and Willem Dafoe and Forrest Whitaker and Johnny Depp and Charlie Sheen and a bunch of others. And I took them into the mountains of the jungles mm-hmm. in the Philippines. And for 3 weeks, I beat the snot out of them. I made them understand exactly how we thought.
Right.
How we felt, how we treated each other. Mm-hmm. And I brought them down out of there, and they were just mentally and emotionally, they were just like we were as 19-year-old kids in that jungle. And when we began to do the film, it paid off because they had been trained so well and under such arduous conditions that they couldn't lie.
Right.
They couldn't lie on screen. And that came through. It really smoked through. So we made a little $5 million movie, chump change in today's mm-hmm. world. And we brought it home. And lo and behold, we won 4 Academy Awards, including Best Picture and Best Director for Oliver. Mm-hmm. And he was gracious enough to mention what a big asset I had been to the making of the film. Mm-hmm. And so what happened is all those people who were throwing me off the lot previously now wanted my phone number and were calling me.
They were knocking down your door now
that's
that,
right.
You got blessed off by an Academy Award winner.
Nothing succeeds like success.
That's it. So did you, having fought in the war yourself, did you have a sense of responsibility to these men and ultimately all the audience that was going to see this film to make it right? Or did you have any sort of apprehension about a war you fought in?
I had apprehensions because both Oliver and I had many occasions of serious flashbacks mm-hmm. because we were making it so real. And there was some emotional pain in that. There was some psychological pain in that. But I had an agenda, and I continue. That agenda has never changed since I got into this business. And it's very simply this: to shine some long overdue light on the men and women who've worn our uniform and who wear our uniform today. I think they've been mistreated in the media. I think they've been misrepresented in the media. We're doing better, and I like to think I had a little bit to do with that. But I want, and they deserve, better treatment, mm-hmm. A more understanding treatment. Because, look, this is America. And those of us who wear a uniform serve the nation, serve the people of the nation, because the nation is the people. Mm-hmm. And without getting on a soapbox here, I would tell you that we need for that nation that we serve to understand us. Mm-hmm. They really need to understand why we're all a little bit wacko half the time, and what service does to us and what it means to us. They need to get a glimpse in our minds and in our hearts and in our guts. And what occurred to me, frankly, was that the popular media is the place to do that. Mm-hmm. Look, I would love for every young American and every old American, for that matter, to read all of the wonderful books that have been brought out about the war experience. But we're trending away from that. People just won't read. They won't sit still long enough. And so the popular media is really the platform. And that's what I locked onto. And I'm still trying to do it to this day.
Yeah. And that movie Platoon kind of really set forth in motion a career that now has spanned multiple decades, not just as a technical advisor, but as we saw even in Platoon, as an actor as well. Did you set out to do both? And how do you decide, am I going to act in this one and be the technical advisor, or one or the other? What is that process like?
Well, early on, no, I did not set out to be one, to be an actor. Mm-hmm. In fact, on Platoon, which was my first acting debut, if you will, Oliver drafted me. He said, look, you're the company commander. All these troops think of you as the company commander, so you're going to be the company commander. I said, oh, listen, wait a minute. Now, these guys have been to drama school, and, mm-hmm. you know, they've studied this, and I'm just a schlub. He said, that's right. You're just a schlub who commands men, and you understand leadership, and I want you to do that on camera. So I did, and I have to say that the young guys who were in the platoon were really supportive of it. And what happened after that was that the critics – noticed. Mm-hmm. They said, we don't know who that guy is, but he's convincing.
Yep.
And so it kind of led to a lot of other things, and suddenly I became an actor. And what I discovered was that I enjoy it, because it's, once again, going back to that agenda, it's an opportunity for somebody who knows the drill to portray the drill mm-hmm. on screen. And it's never been hard for me. Look, I have always been that, I guess it's my Irish heritage or something, but I'm always that shaggy dog storyteller around the campfire. You know, sure. I'll keep you there for 45 minutes to tell you a story that's all BS anyway. And I like that. I've always been that kind of, I like to entertain people. I like to bring a smile or, mm-hmm. or create a reaction in people, either an emotional reaction or a psychological reaction. And that's really what acting is. I mean, it's about, being able to convince people that you're telling the truth when you're not.
Right.
And all of that vastly oversimplifies things. But look, when I get a script, sometimes they will send it to me and say, look, and we want you to be the advisor on this. And by the way, look at the role of
so-and-so.
Mm-hmm. Bretz, you know, and we want you to be that. So sometimes that happens. It happens mm-hmm. a lot more nowadays than it used to. Yeah. It used to be that I would go through it and say, okay, I can do this. I know how to do this. I know the history of this, and I know how to train the people to do this. And there's this wonderful role here, and I'll politic for that. Mm-hmm. But nowadays, it's kind of, I'm accepted as, you know, if you want some guy who speaks the language and can bring some reality to all that gobbledygook jargon, mm-hmm. get die.
Yeah, well, and as I've mentioned at the top when I was introducing you, I mean, some of these films that you've been a part of are just unbelievable, well-known, very awarded, and one that comes to mind that I think resonates a lot with our audience and we talk about and reference a lot is Band of Brothers.
Oh, yeah.
And certainly, you know, you're talking about you getting to work with Steven Spielberg, with Tom Hanks, but more importantly, you were portraying a unit that probably prior to Band of Brothers, most people didn't know about.
So they didn't. Yeah.
What was it like getting involved in that project and working with people of that caliber?
Look, um, I I didn't know Stephen or Tom Hanks prior to that, mm-hmm. but I got a call, and it was Steven Spielberg. And Spielberg had been a fan. I didn't know this, but he'd been a fan of my work in Platoon.
Mm-hmm.
And he'd heard about what I'd done and so on and so forth and how I'd trained the actors. And he said, look, we want you to come in and we want you to do. Look, when you get a call from Steven Spielberg, you jump in the truck and down you
right.
go. So, and that's where I met Tom Hanks. And we decided that this was going to be one we were going to do right.
Mm-hmm.
And they really gave me sort of carte blanche. They said, look, whatever you need to train these people and get it right, let's get it done. And so it was, I actually did look at the role when I began to read the scripts. I did look at the role of Colonel Sink,
mm-hmm.
Who was the commanding officer of the 506 Parachute Infantry Regiment, of which Easy Company was part. And I said, you know, I know this guy. He's the crusty kind of leader that I think I was.
Mm-hmm.
And I really know this. So I went to Tom Hanks and I said, look, I think this was at the end of our training. I went and said, you know, I don't know if you've cast an actor yet, but I really need to do Colonel Sink. And he was very supportive. He said, yeah, you know, I think you do. And so I got cast as Colonel Sink, and it was a wonderful acting experience. I love to portray somebody on screen that's real.
Mm-hmm.
I played Leonard Wood, for instance, in the Rough Riders with Tom Berenger as Teddy Roosevelt, and I was able to study him and find out who he was and what he was about and that sort of thing. And with Sink. Who retired from as a major general from the United States Army. With him, I was able to contact his family and really research him. They sent me, I found some tapes of speeches that Colonel Sink had given. Mm-hmm. And so I'd walk around listening to them all day so I could get that North Carolina drawl that he spoke with. And when you're a little mimic, when you're a little actor, you know, you kind of learn how to do that. So, so that was a joy, a real joy, because I had trained Easy Company, and they all looked at me as kind of the colonel anyway.
Right.
So it slid right in, and it fit right in, and it was a really, really a comfortable coat to wear during the 9 months it took us to do Band of Brothers.
Yeah, and it just made sense, obviously, that you were their commander after having commanded them in the technical advisor role. Did you know, though, when you were – all filming that miniseries, did you know that it was going to be special? Did you have a sense of what it was going to be, or this was just another project for you?
No, it was something special. And that had to do with it being Steven Spielberg and,
sure.
and Tom Hanks. So I knew that it wasn't going to be amateur hour.
Mm-hmm.
And I was very, very familiar with the book, Band of Brothers, Stephen Ambrose.
Sure.
And I had read it a number of times, and I knew what he was after. He was after little individual stories, not the big broad brush that you see in The Longest Day and mm-hmm. Bridge Too Far and so on. So he focused on that one company, and the men who made up that company, and the man who led it, of course, Dick Winters, and so I knew that if we paid attention, if we did it in the spirit of Ambrose's interviews and in the spirit of the people, and at the time, of course, some of them were still alive. And so we were able to talk to them and kind of enmesh their actual experience, their firsthand experiences with what we were doing. So I knew it was going to be something special. How special, I didn't know. I mean, to this day, it's one of those things that I'm very happy and very proud, but it's going to be a legacy.
Mm-hmm.
That will live on long after all of us. And even the actors to this day, we're all in contact with each other.
That's awesome. And
we have a barbecue once a year and everybody comes in, and it's really fantastic. We've gone on to do other things, but Band of Brothers is the common denominator.
Got it. And I can't say enough. It really, it's such an an unbelievable series. You were amazing in it, and it's something that I truly enjoy, and I've watched, you know, probably more than 30 times at this point. But speaking of just military movies in general, do you ever just watch things on television or, you know, at the movies that you were not working on yourself and kind of just nitpick? Is it just a force of habit at this
point? Sure. No, it is a force of habit. In fact, my wife tells me she can't watch a military movie with me because, you know, I'll just say, no, that's wrong, and why is that communist doing that? And, you know. So I do watch them. I watch a lot of things that I didn't work on, a lot of the old things, because it gives me a basis of comparison. You know, I can look at this and say, oh my God, come on. You know, that's nonsense. And didn't they know better? And plain fact of the matter is they didn't, with some exceptions. I mean, I'm a huge fan of Sam Fuller. And I just, the other day, here in Los Angeles, his steel helmet was on.
Mm-hmm.
What a marvelous film. And he did it for $250,000 in some park here mm-hmm. in L.A. But Fuller, because of his own experience with the 1st Infantry Division in World War II, mm-hmm. he knows soldiers and he knows how they react. And so with the exception of people like Fuller, I'm pretty critical of the old stuff that was done.
Sure.
I understand
sure.
why it was done.
Sure.
But I think we do a much better job today.
Thanks to the Dale Dyes of the world.
So
in addition to the movies and television, though, you're also an accomplished novelist. And what are you working on currently?
Well, I thank you for the adjective accomplished. I am a novelist. The thing about me is that motion pictures and television, where I've made my reputation and my name, they only do war movies every once in a while.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to keep at it. I wanted to keep hammering that agenda of mine. And so being a creative type with a degree in English literature, you know, I decided I would start telling stories in books.
Mm-hmm.
And I did that. And I think to date I've got about 13 or 14 novels out there.
That's unbelievable.
The current one, thank you. In fact, my wife and I started our own publishing company because we got tired of the New York nonsense.
Sure.
And we started a company called Warriors Publishing Group, mm-hmm. Which is an offshoot of my company, Warriors Incorporated, which is technical advisor to movies and television. And we've done just magic with it. We've got some great titles, including my own, but not necessarily just my own. We didn't do it for that reason. We've got, for instance, Delvecchio's 13th Valley.
Mm-hmm.
A great Vietnam book. We got the reprint rights to that, and we now publish all of his books. But my books, I've been a great fan of Lee Child and the Jack Reacher character. I mean, that just trips my trigger. I love that. Although I've never met Lee Child, I would like to one of these days. And so I decided, you know, maybe I'll do a series with a recurring character.
Sure.
And so I did. I started the File series of books, and the character is a retired Marine. Ha! How about that? By the name of Sheik Davis.
Mm-hmm.
And the hook to the books, he gets himself involved in all sorts of precarious situations around the world, working sub rosa for various intelligence agencies and that sort of thing. But the hook is that in each book, he either gets involved in or revisits some famous battlefield. The Chosen File, he goes to North Korea. The Beirut File, he goes to Beirut. Aztec File, he goes to the halls of Montezuma. And the most recent one, the ninth book in the series, is mm-hmm. a book called Delta File. Watch this. This is how good I am at this. It's called Delta File.
There you go.
And it's more personal than all of the rest of them. You get a look at who Sheik Davis is
mm-hmm.
and where he came from and that sort of thing. And he gets involved in a nefarious adventure while he's retracing his boyhood footsteps.
Well, that's
and they're all available, by the way, on Amazon as ebooks in any format that you want, or at Warriors Publishing Group.
Well, that's fantastic. And, you know, I think you strike me, sir, as someone I could talk to for hours on end, but I've taken a lot of your time already, and just know that, you know, I really respect the fact that you found your way and became very accomplished after your military career. So oftentimes veterans have a tough time finding their way, and you certainly did that and carved out a tremendous life for yourself working in Hollywood. And I'll just leave you with these last two quick questions before we wrap up.
Okay, but before you do that, let me say that that's a very high compliment from you, because I do it for guys like you, guys who understand.
So we appreciate it, sir.
Now carry on with your question.
I mean, you've worked with unbelievable people. So real quick, favorite actor you've ever worked with?
Probably Tom Berenger, Tommy Lee Jones, Tom Hanks, Morgan Freeman.
So all the Toms.
All the Toms. Morgan Freeman is a great guy to work with.
I mean, he's pretty accomplished himself, so that's a great answer. And then I feel like I might know the answer to the second one, but favorite director you've worked with?
There are a number of them. I really like a director by the name of John Dahl, who did The Great Raid. I like Oliver Stone, although nobody else seems to. I think Steven Spielberg, that's the answer I thought you were expecting, is wonderful to work for. Mm-hmm. What the directors who are really close to my heart are the ones who use me properly, mm-hmm. who keep me at their elbow, and let me help with performances and that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. Because they know I now speak the language that their actors are speaking. Right. So those guys are terrific. And there's probably six or eight more, but you caught me flat-footed. So take those as a start.
All right. Well, sir, I appreciate your time today. If you ever find yourself consulting on a movie about a veteran turned podcaster, I'm happy to help you consult on that. But for today, I appreciate you.
Listen, the way Hollywood is going, it may be that's the only thing we can do is movies about podcasters in a remote fashion.
Well, I'll be ready. I'll be ready when you make that phone call. So.
All right. Good deal.
All right. Thank
Please
you very much,
Please say hi
sir.
To everybody there at your headquarters. I'm sorry I didn't get to meet the other two, but maybe we'll do another one later on.
Absolutely. That'd be fantastic. So thank you very much, sir. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Great name too, Dale Dye.
Yeah, fantastic. Such a good name. Such
awesome.
A good name. And
awesome.
Like looking at his list, Saving Private Ryan, Rules of Engagement, Starship Trooper, Mission Impossible, Sergeant Bilko, like so many good, I don't know, just pretty cool looking
the
at his
code
whole list
on
of
there,
things.
I think.
Yeah, the code, Pisces. Yes. He was the only one who had a haircut, turns out, in that one. Yeah, yeah. Indeed. That's really cool, though.
I could have easily, the way he tells stories was fantastic, and I could listen to him tell stories like that. I had so many more questions that I didn't even get to, so hopefully we'll have him back another time. He was an absolute lovely, lovely man.
We're going to try to get this next person that we're going to talk about in round number four on the show as well. Her name is Kathy Sullivan. Tell us a little bit about her, Kate.
Yes. So, very cool. Kathy Sullivan, America's first female spacewalker, also became the first woman to reach the deepest known point in the ocean.
It ain't nothing to stunt.
This woman has been the highest and the lowest of all the women in the world. Sullivan dove to the bottom of the Challenger Deep and safely returned in her submersible vessel on Monday. She's now the eighth person to reach that depth in the Marianas Trench. 35.
Oh, here we go.
Kate versus numbers.
Oh, yes.
Here comes Kate versus
and
numbers.
Kate put this on the sheets. She only has herself to blame. She could have wrote this out
what
easy.
What is that number, Kate?
What do we got, Kate?
853 under the Western Pacific Ocean. A call was made between Sullivan's vessel at the bottom of the ocean, and what a stunt. She goes to the bottom of the ocean, and ring-a-ding-ding, she calls the International Space Station from down there. Okay.
I wonder what the delay is like.
I know. Probably a slight bit of a delay. The call was a homage.
We add a baby, it's a boy.
Yeah, we add a baby, it's a boy. Click. So the call was a homage to Sullivan's other historic venture when she became the first American woman to walk in space in 84. As a hybrid oceanographer and astronaut, this was an...
Not at 84, in 1984.
In 84. What a line this is, though. As a hybrid oceanographer and astronaut, this was an extra... Wow. Yeah, to say both of those things in one sentence. This is Kim level. That guy who has like the world's best intro that we ever read before.
Oh, Johnny Kim.
Johnny Kim.
Yeah, yeah. So anyway, once in a lifetime day, seeing the moonscape of the Challenger Deep and then comparing notes with my colleagues aboard the International Space Station about our remarkable reusable interspace outer space craft, she said in a press release, the two groups of humans using cutting-edge technology to explore the outer edges of our world is highlighted in the vast span of human endeavor, while at the same time linking us closer together as fellow explorers, the first two people to reach the Challenger Deep, and this blows my mind, located in the south end of the Mariana Trench, about 190 miles southwest of Guam, were Don Walsh and Jacques Piccard in 1960. I couldn't believe they did it in 1960. They went all the way down to 35.
Probably a lot more dangerous in 1960 with whatever technology they were working with back then.
Yeah, it's crazy. They said it's very peaceful down there. They turned the thrusters off, leaned back in the cockpit, and enjoyed a tuna fish sandwich while I very slowly drifted just above the bottom of the deepest place on Earth, enjoying the view. So, holy shitballs. So, Avatar Titanic guy, James Cameron, he also went down there. So, he went down there alone, but holy shitballs. I mean,
to be nearly 7 miles below sea level is just banana land. And I firmly believe, I stand on this. There is stuff in the ocean we still haven't found yet and still have not discovered. So I can only imagine she might have seen some things that the rest of us are not privy to, and I'm jealous of that.
Sea cucumbers. Probably. A lot of them. Way down there.
Imagine how big they are down there.
The pressure down there, they said, is like the equivalent of having 100 elephants stand on your head. Like, you would, one tiny little leak and you are just
toast.
You're just crumpled and squished down. So,
Like, I love how we just like kind of pass these things off as a society because we just assume like, oh, like whatever. But like, to send people into space and then to send people to the bottom of the ocean is just a feat of science that most of us cannot even wrap our brains around.
Yeah. No, I definitely can't. When I was watching the two folks that just went up to the International Space Station, and one of the guys was getting interviewed and the other one was standing there with a stuffed animal of like a dinosaur that's floating around, I'd be doing all kinds of shit. I'd be stunting every second I got, man. I would be like, oh yeah, I'm in space, whatever. When they're taking the little pictures, looking down and seeing what Earth looks like as this blue ball, it has to be overwhelming. Like, I don't know how you're smart enough to wrap your head around where you're at when you're in space. Like, how you look around, but I'm in fucking outer space. Like, how do you think about that?
It's nuts.
Now, there's a luxury vessel, okay? I have a luxury vessel. I pull up to your house. Safety, 100%, you're going to be safe. But you can only go to outer space or to the bottom of the ocean with me and a bunch of tuna fish sandwiches. What are we doing?
Space.
Space, for sure.
Okay.
There is less people that have been down to that depth than there have been in space. But if you're at the bar and you're like, hey, I've been to the deepest spot in the ocean. Oh, cool, dude.
Whatever. Yeah.
All right.
I've been to space. You said you go to space?
Let's talk next
and
round.
Guess
on me.
What? Guess what? It's aluminum chair Hanes time. If you tell
somebody nobody goes right. down and says, oh, hey, how did you shit when you were down there at the bottom of the ocean? They want to know how you shit in space.
Exactly.
That's true. That's true. So I guess, but to have both under your belt, pretty impressive. I say she's not just the only woman to do that. She's the only person on the planet to be at the highest high and the lowest low.
That's a stunt if I ever heard one.
Stunt on him, Kathy. Fucking love it.
How the fuck did you come down there?
Yeah, we have some very important questions for you if you'll come on the show.
Hey, how'd you come?
Do you have to poop down there?
Hey, when you pooped, did you come?
I hate this show. Next.
All right, let's move on to round number 5, serious issue. We're gonna
She's
talk
a
little
respectable
bit
of- lady.
Yeah, I wasn't talking about her. I was talking about myself. So whenever we go to round number 5, we're going to talk a little bit about the protests that were going on in D.C. We mentioned it last week that there was a gentleman who was standing outside the phalanx that was there in D.C. and telling him to tighten it up. We wanted to talk to him, so we brought him on the show. Here he is, Wayne Carmaden. All right, now zero block 30. We talked about it a couple weeks ago that there was a gentleman at a protest that saw some of this phalanx that was all fucked up. And I thought at the time, I was like, this dude's a staff sergeant. He's a sergeant for his class and something like that. He's getting out there and getting after it. We tracked it down and we got Wayne Carmaden on the show. Wayne, thanks for joining us, man.
Hey, pleasure to be here.
So you were telling me that you actually didn't get out as the NCO. I was wrong, right?
Yeah, I didn't get out as an NCO. I was just, you know, I was just high speed. That's what a lot of people know. I was just really, really high speed and a leader, you know.
And so you took it upon yourself whenever you were out there. You saw it because you didn't want the protest to be, from what I saw, you wanted your voices to be heard, that everybody that was out there protesting your voices to be heard, but not in a violent way towards the National Guard.
Right, especially towards the National Guard specifically, because in probably like 1 or 2 months, I'm supposed to reenlist to become DC National Guard again. So I'm like, man, I still got friends here. Mm-hmm. I was like, I gotta try to de-escalate or like deflect as much as possible.
Yeah, that's what I told my co-host. I was like, this is a beautiful situation. He's out there doing the right thing. He sees like the phalanx is messed up. You gotta get closer together. What was the scene that was going on? How were the soldiers responding to you?
Okay, so you say how were they responding
to
me? So they responded like pretty like good. But I think it's because the prior conversations before that actual clip got recorded, I think it's because of the prior conversations I had with like most of them individually. I went down the line, you know how like people are in formation mm-hmm. and like the platoon sergeant goes down the line to each person. I literally went down the line and was like, I'm here for to uplift y'all motivation and stuff like that, because when I first got there, everybody was like shouting crazy stuff at them, and I was like, man, let me try to like motivate everybody here. And I let them know that I was prior service, and I was like, this isn't like sarcasm, because they were really standoffish. They weren't saying anything. They wouldn't give you a head nod or nothing. I'm like, bro, I'm like y'all brothers, you know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. So like, y'all, it's okay for y'all to respond back to me. Like, I'm not one of the wild, crazy protesters saying like crazy stuff. I'm one of you. And I kept saying like, oh, and it was like, oh my God, he knows something.
And what was that like for you to be out there and show and having your voice and letting your voice be heard?
It was an amazing experience. It's just it's kind of like for the people like me who, of course, I'm African American, that's visibly to see, and like someone who is like in, who really cares about, you know, the military and my battle buddies and stuff out there, my fellow like airmen, Marines and stuff like that. It's really like you put in a position where you're like in the middle of everything. Mm-hmm. So like what I was telling, it was a Marine out there who claims that he used to be a Marine, and he had said the wrong thing, and I had to kind of like save him, because I'm telling him, like, if you notice, I think you've been hearing a lot about how it's like a different group of protesters at nighttime. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that different group of protesters come from like my part of the city, like the really rough part. So like when it's nighttime,
right?
Yeah, I'm from DC. Yeah, born and raised.
So going through and seeing that and being on, you said you're torn and kind of felt like you're in the middle. Can you describe that?
Yeah. So basically, like, it was times where like, okay, we had three on a protester side. We had like three people like really lead, and like I'm talking about like Sergeant Major Lee and these mm-hmm. protesters, and like they were like I can't even explain like some of the stuff they were saying to them. Like, it was like really like intense stuff. And being though I'm a protester and not in the Guard right now currently, mm-hmm. it's just that I know for a fact if I would have shown like upfront support of like the Guard, like, hey, don't talk like this to the Guard, they would have definitely turned on me. I mean, I know how to handle myself, but they would have turned on me, and it would have been a situation I would have had to, you know, go another route. But that's an example. Like, it was crazy. That's why I was really like torn.
I think that's some of the more touching aspects of what I've seen, like just watching it, is other Black soldiers and airmen and sailors and Marines that felt kind of the same way. There's one clip that went really viral where a guy that was in, I believe he's in the National Guard, and standing there, and while the crowd and the protesters are cheering Black Lives Matter, he's saying it too. And I think it's not a political thing, right? Like, we should come together as brothers in arms, sisters in arms, and join hands together and say, this is not
politics. This is not anything like that. This is right. us being looking out for our fellow human beings.
Right, exactly. And it's that guy actually comes from the DC National Guard too. Yeah, he comes from the DC. I see a lot of my like old battle buddies post them more like Facebook and Instagram and stuff like that. So it's just, and then being the nation's capital, mm-hmm. like it's gotten, you know what I'm saying, crazy. But the mayor just like passed some laws like to stop some of the craziness. Like, I know you know, what is it? I think Minneapolis, they just passed a little law where they can't use like those tactics that kill, mm-hmm. you know.
Where they're not allowed to use chokeholds, and the officers are responsible for if somebody's, if a cop is going too far, to have to step in the intervention laws.
Right, and the same thing just got passed in D.C., so I don't think there's going to be like too much like rowdy protest anymore because, you know, they can't use that force no more. But also people have to understand like the District of Columbia, D.C. is different from states. Mm-hmm. So even though she passed it, it's like, okay, does that mean D.C. Metropolitan Police can't use it? Now, what about federal? Because D.C. don't control the federal unless you're talking about like federal D.C., so what does that mean for Secret Service and United States Park Police? Are they allowed to use those tactics on the protesters? Because they don't fall under Washington, D.C. as, you know, the city and the mayor. They don't fall under the mayor. They fall
and
under...
And I think just conversations like that, it goes to show what somebody like a black man in America has to deal with. That's not even something that would cross my mind. Like, as a white guy, like, does that apply to everybody? Is this cop going to be able to do it and that cop's not going to be able to do it?
And it... Right. And the thing is, literally, if it wasn't for the DC National Guard or the military in general, I wouldn't be thinking like this, you know? Like, I wouldn't have the thought process and stuff like that to even think about that. But because I joined and now I know the difference between federal, local government and stuff mm-hmm. like that, you have to, like, if you really care, you have to throw questions and stuff like that into play. Because I don't want people to just, like, be happy. Oh, they can't do this no more. But, like, and then you get choked out next week by somebody in the Secret Service or U.S. Park Police. Now you're like, what happened? I thought they said you can't do that. Then another rowdy. So it's just, it's crazy, like, rules and loopholes and stuff that's going on right now.
And I'm glad that you're out there sharing your voice. You must have thought that you were... the moment that you were going viral on the internet, what's going through your mind?
Oh man, I didn't. Okay, so I had did an interview with Fox reporter Griff, I think that's his name, and I didn't think it was going to like be too, you know, too big until I like shared the post. He was like, "Oh yeah, cool," and then like local like. Curator pages started posting me, and then my friend who's a photographer really known in DC, he was like, "Hey bro, is this you?" I'm like, "What are you talking about?" And I look at the video and it's another video from somebody's like YouTube or something, and I'm like, "Oh, what?" And that's when I see all y'all pages and stuff.
See, that's why you need to go whenever you go back into the DC Guard, which you said you were planning on doing, you need to bring that to the first sergeant and be like, "Look, I got the skills. You could see it right here. This is the NCO leadership ability that I got right here."
Definitely. My whole goal, when I was in the military, my whole goal, I wanted to become a drill sergeant. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? My time was cut short, but, like, I am now able to, like, re-enlist. So I'm focusing on trying to, like, lose this weight so I can pass MEPS and go re-enlist. So when go. I find this, I'm going to
tell you. Your duck walk coming along. You're going to crush the duck walk?
Oh, yeah, I crushed it. See, back in August, I had went to MEPS. I crushed everything. And, like, I was, like, the last person they tape. And because they could physically see that I wasn't, like, yeah. So they tried to tape me. A lot of you not. We sat there for, like, 30 minutes trying to squeeze the tape. He's like, "Maybe we can get this to pass."
Yeah.
He's like, "Bro, we just can't, bro. You got to come back, bro." I was like, "Oh, man." So that stuck, bro. I'm going to get back on it.
There you go. Well, good luck to you, Wayne. Thanks for joining us, and we appreciate you sharing your voice and using that First Amendment right.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Thanks to Wayne for taking the time and joining us. I think that's cool when you have a moment that goes viral and you're not expecting it and you're just out there trying to goof because you can commiserate. Like, you know, you've been on both sides. You're a protester now. You've been on the side where you're in the National Guard. And it's not about us versus them. It's just about making their voices heard. I think that's important to remember.
And two, for any listeners who have been National Guard and they're out at the protests and stuff, that's not easy. And I'm reading from people's firsthand experiences how difficult that is, because you love your fellow country members and you also have a job to do, and there's people coming at you and it's very difficult. So I know that's not easy. So just got a couple DMs too from people who have been in that position now who are just stressed the fuck out. So thinking of you, sending good vibes your way.
And we also want to, before we moved in, save rounds and alibis, we also want to mention the fact that we want to do a Pride episode or two during June, because June is Pride Month. We want to highlight some of those stories, because like Kate mentioned, I believe in round number two, where we talked about a lot of times people of color get left out of the historical narrative of the military. So do people who are gay, lesbians, trans, whatever. We want to talk to you and talk about your stories, the struggles that you might have had in the 80s, 90s, early 2000s, or what it was like coming out. I think that those stories are going to be important. We want to highlight some of those.
And triumphs, too. If you have any triumphs you want to share. But yeah, if you're LGBTQ or you...
What it was like the first time you got to go to the Marine Corps ball and dance up on your dude.
Exactly. So yeah, we want to hear from you and your stories and I don't know. I just really think it's important and I think we should do it. So hit us up in our DMs, any one of us, and we'll get back to you. And we'll do kind of like Chaps does with the big day of interviews and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. We'll have you on the show. Or if even anonymously, if you want to share your stories, just send them in the DMs. Tell us whether you want to be known or not, whatever. Mm-hmm. But happy to hear from you.
No doubt. Yeah. Let's move on to save rounds. Alibis, we'll start with you, Cons. What do you got?
So Sunday, June 14th, way back when, June 14th, 1775, my beloved Army was born. So happy birthday to the U.S. Army. Also, it's Flag Day for those wanting to celebrate. And then also, I just want to shout
Nelson
out...
And Nelson Mandela's birthday.
Oh, wow. Nelson Mandela's birthday. Did not know that. That's awesome. I just also want to shout out American Ingenuity, because as we climb out of this quarantine and restaurants in New York and New Jersey are starting to get the go-ahead to open back up, but they can only have outdoor seating. I've seen, obviously, a lot of restaurants. Shout out to the Wooden Spoon. Shout out to Borelli's on Long Island. And there's a lot of restaurants doing this in Hoboken where they're kind of adapting and overcoming. And where they might not have had tables before, like, oh, well, we own that part of the street. Let's just build some more tables out there. And I think that's great that these small restaurants and companies are making the most of coming out of this quarantine strong. And I think that's just like the best of what America has to offer. And I wish all of them the best of luck as they rebound with their businesses.
And I know, Cons, you and I are going to do our best to support them.
Oh, yeah.
Especially if they have a good frozen drink.
Seriously.
There you have it. A happy Catherine. Birthday, Army. Mm. Anyways, first of all, I...
Just to caveat on that, Army, happy birthday. I, too, would like to wish the Army a happy birthday.
Just want to piggyback on that. I have a couple points I'd like to... So, first of all, Kyle does the best job ever with our social media. Has, like, skyrocketed us from where we were. And incredible job. Every now and then, I take the reins of that sucker. And I just put something dumb up there that is clearly not from Kyle. And I had this hilarious idea to say, hey, everybody, text your friends and tell them you just decided to join the military again, oh, well, and then tell me the responses. Well, it just ended up upsetting a lot of people. I'm really sorry. I sent it to Kyle, or to Nate and Pat that I work with, and instead of texting me back, like, what, blah, 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 for, like, a funny screenshot, they both called me immediately and were like, are you okay? Why'd you do that? You're not happy at work? Blah, blah, blah. And I was like, oh, I'm sorry. So, yeah, that sucked. Also, I'd like to give a shout-out. Sometimes you just get the sweetest DMs. Jerry Sands. He says, Kate, I'm 14 and me and my dad love your podcast. And so in the next episode, I was wondering if you could maybe mention us. My name is Jerry. His name's Jeremy. Thank you. I love you so much. You are so funny. And first of all, a huge shout out to Jerry for noting me among, he didn't mention any of you guys. So
no, you just like, shit. Sorry,
now I didn't know there's a 14-year-old. I would like to apologize for the shit and cum stuff I was talking about earlier.
Yeah, I gotta be honest. I had no idea we went that low in age.
Yeah, sorry about that. So,
It's a family show now.
Jerry, sorry. And to Jerry's father, I'm especially sorry.
Especially sorry to Jeremy. Whoop-a-doo.
Sorry about that.
But thank you for listening. Sorry about the all that other stuff.
Kyle, you got anything? Oh. You got any save rounds, Kyle?
Kyle forgot to unmute himself, but he said no.
No.
What a noob.
I'm here.
Oh, there he is.
Still,
what a boot.
I got nothing.
Ladies and gentlemen, Kyle.
Kyle, welcome to the show, Kyle. First time.
Big debut.
Love it. Thanks, no, Kyle.
No problem. Anytime, guys.
I also have nothing really. It's been a wild week here.
Well, you had a nice week. You want to mention, I'm sure you've mentioned it other places, but would you like to mention, you know, what you got to do this week?
What did I get to do, Cons?
For your one daughter?
Oh, yeah. I bought my kid a car. That was a nice little experience. Had a little cry with her.
Make sure she parks it in the driveway at night.
No, mm-hmm. We don't have room, man. I don't know what I'm going to do. That wasn't something that I even really thought about. We have the double car driveway, but all the kids are playing basketball and swimming and doing all that kind of stuff in the driveway now. I'm not sure where we're going to put this fucking thing. Dad problems. Maybe I'll have to build another one. I might build the bike thing this weekend. Might do a little bit of goofing. Who knows? We'll see. Well, either way, we'll see you back on Tuesday. Thanks for joining us, everybody. And also, make sure you go to the Barstool Sports Store, pick up your new ZBT gear. There should be some new stuff in there dropping pretty soon if you haven't. If anything's out of stock and you want it back in stock, reach out to us. Email us. Email cons@barstoolsports.com and let him know what you want to see into the store. He always loves that.
I answer every DM and email, and it's a blessing and a curse.
Put it to a test again.
Especially if you're enlisted then and you want to tell an officer what to do, just mm-hmm. just message him and say, reply to me, clown.
Yeah. See how he responds. And if he doesn't reply back in like the first 3 hours, then we'll call him an integrity violator on the show.
Exactly. Uh-huh.
Great. Can't wait for that this weekend.
Yeah.
We'll see you guys back here on Tuesday. Thanks for joining us.